Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President. UUPinfo.org.
Joining us on the Legislative Gazette this week is Yancey Roy, Albany Bureau Chief for Newsday. And Yancey's been covering the legislature for quite a long time. Yancey, thanks for joining us on the Legislative Gazette this week.
Hey, no problem.
By the way, how long have you been covering the legislature?
Oh, gosh, you're going to make me
count that up.
Yes, I am. And I'll feel really old. I don't know. I certainly was here from the Pataki administration on, so...
So we're talking, decades.
Yeah.
You are a veteran journalist at this point covering the legislature, and you've seen a lot of end of sessions, and there's always negotiations down to the wire. First, we talk about the budget, then the budget comes, and there's more negotiations. And one of the big items in this end of session was clean slate. Tell us about the bill. There was an agreement on it and what it means.
Well, clean slate is the phrase that advocates have used for a bill that would provide for automatic sealing of criminal records after a certain period of finishing your sentence and then not getting into any trouble for a certain period of time. What they're talking about is if you've committed a misdemeanor and you've finished your sentence, 3 years after that, you can get your criminal record sealed. For a felony, it would be 8 years. Now, not all felonies, though, are eligible. In fact, there's a whole slew of them that are deemed basically so serious that you'd never get them sealed. And some of those are some obvious things, such as murder, any sex crime, any Class A, what's called Class A felony, which is the most serious felony on the books in New York. Those would never be able to be sealed. And the logic behind sealing of some of the lower level stuff is that having a criminal record follow you through your life sometimes prevents you from getting a job or maybe housing. And there's certainly examples of someone who maybe got into some sort of fight or brawl when you were 20 years old and you got convicted of an assault and you finished your sentence years ago and now you're in your 40s and you're trying to get a job and maybe this assault conviction when you were young prevents you from getting a job. And so that's the scenario that, advocates have put out there is why we should have sealed records. And by and large, it's won a lot of support from Democrats, not so much Republicans. The District Attorneys Association, which has also been influential through the years in New York, says they like the concept because getting your records sealed right now is just too complicated and no one can do it without a lawyer. But they also don't like the broadness of the statute. They said there should be some, among other things, some judicial oversight in determining whether a record should be sealed. But they've not won that argument. And so the bill's going to go through on Friday is what the expectation is.
Well, I wonder what you make of a last-minute housing agreement between the Senate and the Assembly. We're talking about Carl Hastie, the Speaker of the Assembly, and Andrew Stewart Cousins of the Senate. The political issue here is that the governor had introduced a housing proposal that got shot down, basically, early on. And now at the last minute, they come up with this housing proposal, and the governor's not in on it. And a little bit of war of words going on between the executive and the legislative branch.
And the package put forth by either corner has like been so broad that it's included things that the other sides didn't want to support. Hochul did make it a top priority back when she presented her budget in January or February. She wanted a housing mandate with a mechanism that could override local zoning. That was seen as a poison pill by the legislature. The legislature, knowing that housing crunch is an issue, tried to put together something here in the last week or so. It would have included a bunch of things, including something, expansion of something called 421A, which is a tax incentive for developers. But it would have also included what's been called good cause conviction law, which means basically it's harder to evict tenants from apartments. Opponents of that law say it's too strict and you would never be able to evict anyone. Certainly the Hochul administration had made it clear it didn't want the broad package that included this, and so it was going to be vetoed. So the whole thing fell apart on Thursday afternoon. And rather than push forward with a bill that was likely to get vetoed, the legislature's decided, let's just, you know, pencils down now for this year, and we'll come back at it next year.
So, Yancey, does that mean there's a slight political difference between the governor and the legislature? In other words, Governor Hochul might be a little more conservative, siding with landlords versus the legislature siding with tenants?
That's a simple way to put it, and that's, you know, broadly what's happened on a lot of disputes is that the governor's a little bit more of a moderate Democrat than the legislature on several things, whether it's criminal justice or incentives for housing. That's broadly the sense there, too. But, you know, you shouldn't always put them in that category. For instance, since the start of this housing debate, Hochul was the one who wanted to push forward more progressive ideas on housing and mandates to build housing, which was aligned with progressive interest in the state. And it was the legislature that didn't want to do that and was more on the side of suburbia and not wanting housing building mandates.
What other issues, major issues, Yancey, were confronting the legislature at the end of this session?
Well, broadly, first thing you should know is that because there's no overarching issue that requires action, like a deadline, like rent control expires or mayoral control of New York City schools expires, there's no big mandate that will require a lot of things to get done this year. So there are some other very interesting things that are kicking around. One of the things that has passed was something referred to as Angelica's Law, which would toughen penalties for driving with suspended licenses. It would make it basically easier to charge a driver with a felony for multiple infractions. There's something called Sammy's Law, which has to do with lowering the speed limit in New York City. It's passed the Senate, and as we speak, it has not passed the Assembly. There's something called the Wrongful Death Statute, which both houses have passed, which would change the way wrongful deaths and lawsuits go forward. It's something that's been long fought for in the legislature. Governor Hochul vetoed that last year. There's also a bill that calls for New York to create a commission study the issue of reparations for past enslaved people. This is dating back to the Civil War. California, of course, California has done so and moved forward with a study. New York legislators passed a bill this week that would create a commission to study the issue.
Here's a question. Did Republicans see any victories at the end of session?
Well, you know, they're in the minority. They're outnumbered 2-1 in the legislature, so they don't have a big hand in crafting bills other than local bills, like they played a role in Angelica's Law, for example. But they use the bully pulpit to bring up issues. And there's also, you know, look, the clean slate is a criminal justice issue. They say it goes too far. They will certainly, you know, in terms of election strategy, the passage of clean slate probably gives them an issue to use in elections next year.
Another session in the books in the New York State Legislature for 2023, and we've been joined by Yancey Roy. He's the Albany Bureau Chief for Newsday, a veteran journalist. He's not that old, no matter what he thinks. And we appreciate, Yancey, you taking the time to talk to us about the end of session, and we'll hope to catch up with you soon.
All right. Thanks, Dave.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Giustina. Now retired Legislative Gazette political observer and WAMC president and CEO Alan Chartok was honored by the New York State Legislature this week in the closing hours of its session. The Legislative Gazette's Ian Pickus with more.
On the resolution, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Democratic Assemblymember Deborah Glick of Manhattan introduced the resolution late Tuesday. It came just after Chartok's retirement in May, following more than four decades running WAMC Northeast Public Radio. As Glick told fellow lawmakers, The New York State Capitol was always key to Shartok's career and focus, including interviews with governors, assembly speakers, and Senate leaders, commissioners, the rank and file, and advocates.
In Albany, you can listen to the Capitol Connection, which focuses on us in the Capitol, Congressional Corner, which reaches across the Northeast, having various congressional members. I know I've been interviewed. I know that our majority leader has been interviewed by Allen.
Assembly Majority Leader Crystal People-Stokes of Buffalo, a frequent Capitol Connection guest, also paid tribute.
I think the thing I appreciated more about his style of questioning, and, you know, I know we're going to lose not having him on the scene anymore, is that he would ask you a question. You know, most times reporters already know what the answers they want to hear from you. If they don't hear it, they ask you another question. He would actually accept the answer that you gave him and allow that to be the answer to the question that he asked. And I have a lot of respect for that.
Republican Keith Brown of the Assembly's 12th District on Long Island says Shartok even indirectly helped his political career get going.
When I was at Albany, I did the internship back in 1990, and Alan Shartok was nice enough to place me with Senator Norman Levy, and it was that internship that made me want to run for the Assembly some 30 years later. So I appreciate very much what Professor Shartok has done for this town, for SUNY New Paltz, for SUNY Albany, and for the legislative process here and enlightening so many of us through the Legislative Gazette.
Democratic Assemblywoman Dee Dee Barrett represents the 106th District.
WAMC covers my entire district. It's one of the important and continuing news sources and programming for many, many people. During all of their fund drives, I would always hear my constituents calling in and making contributions.
Echoing those sentiments was Albany Assemblywoman Patricia Fahey of the 109th District.
40 years is impressive in any profession, but certainly he was known as being tireless and known for his energy, and as Member McDonald and I would often say, known as a character.
Fahey said Shartok deserves credit for inspiring young people to take an interest in state government and policy. Democrat Chris Burdick represents the 93rd Assembly District in Westchester County and recalled his wife listening to WAMC in Shartok's adopted hometown of Great Barrington, Massachusetts.
She said, "You have to listen to this. He is unbelievable, and I couldn't agree more. He was captivating. He always had a great sense of humor and really got to the essence of things without being deprecating or insulting to the people he interviewed. And I too became a devotee of his programs. So I commend the sponsor for bringing this resolution and join in the accolades for Alan Shartok, so well deserved."
Lawmakers approved the resolution by voice vote.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Ian Pickus.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. New York State Inspector General Lucy Lang has jurisdiction over all executive branch agencies, departments, divisions, officers, boards, and commissions, and over most public authorities and public benefit corporations in New York. The Inspector General's functions and responsibilities include receiving and investigating complaints concerning allegations of corruption, fraud, criminal activity, conflicts of interest, or abuse in an entity under the Inspector General's jurisdiction. I spoke with New York State Inspector General Lucy Lang this week and began by asking her about a recent report her office released on workers' compensation.
I spent the past year, or the first year of my tenure as Inspector General, visiting every prison in the state. And as I visited prisons, I spoke to incarcerated people, to administrators, and to staff to try to identify common threads of challenges that they were facing. And this is, of course, a system that has upwards of 30,000 New Yorkers in custody and that employs huge numbers of very committed public servants. One thing that I learned during these visits was that a number of the facilities were significantly understaffed, and that was coming at a great cost, both to the incarcerated populations who were finding that the programs that they needed were limited, and to the staff who were being forced to do mandatory overtime to make up for the fact that other colleagues were out on workers' compensation. So we did an analysis and saw that the volume of corrections officers who were taking advantage of the workers' compensation system seemed inconsistent with those of other agents, other similarly situated agencies. And so we simply audited those, looked at the cases that have come into us alleging egregious instances of workers' compensation fraud in the Department of Corrections, and aggregated that information to provide it to the folks who are currently renegotiating the contract.
Well, let's turn to something a little different. The jurisdiction that you cover as Inspector General includes state-funded infrastructure investments and projects as well. And we're just seeing, I noticed, the Buffalo Bills groundbreaking out in western New York. Governor Kathy Hochul is there, of course. Do you, or have you, as part of your responsibilities, looked at that deal? Was that something that you had to look at?
We do oversee major infrastructure projects, including the Javits Center and the Moynihan Train Hall and others. And it really depends what the provisions of a particular contract are and who the relevant agencies involved in the contract process are, whether or not we take a very active role. So it's something that we look at on a case-by-case basis, which we'll do in this case.
I was looking at your website, which, of course, if anybody wants to go to it, it's ig.ny.gov, and learn more about the Inspector General. One of the things that you said is you want to start promoting the Inspector General's office. A lot of people don't know about the Inspector General and that there's position in New York. And besides coming on a statewide program like this, how else are you getting out the word about what you do? Because people can reach out to your office with complaints, right?
There are two critical reasons that I want to be talking to you all the time and other folks like you who are doing the work of communicating with the public. The first is, of course, that it's critical to government transparency and integrity that people who see wrongdoing report it. And folks can do that by reaching us at 1-800-DO-RIGHT. They can do it through our website, our online complaint form at ig.ny.gov, and they can do it through our social media channels, which are at New York State IG on Twitter and Instagram. And we welcome complaints from the public in all those areas. But the other piece, of course, is that I think it is just vital that young New Yorkers see what a career in public service looks like and that they see that there are opportunities for them to serve. And I think that's particularly true for young women. So I'm really thrilled that this week actually marks the beginning of an expanded internship program at the IG's office. We've welcomed 17 interns to our 7 offices across the state. They're a diverse range of young people who are interested in the work of government integrity, and we're excited to be a part of breeding the next generation of public servants.
Well, you said complaints, and, you know, people love to complain. Is there a boundary here? I mean, your office has got to field so many complaints, and you have to weed out the ones that may not be system-wide, right? Ones that might be individual, maybe they don't rise to the level of your office investigate. How does that all filter out?
I'm so glad that you asked, because it's an area that we've been really focused on over the course of the past 18 months. We receive upwards of 5,000 complaints a year, and that number is growing. And with each complaint that comes in, we have really worked to first, of course, identify if there's criminal wrongdoing or fraud or something that we need to pursue as a complete investigation. We do that, and that is our real area of expertise. But many of them are people who have been to other state agencies, have complained to other sources, and feel that they're not getting adequate information. So we have undertaken a trauma-informed training for all of our staff, particularly those who are interfacing with the public, who are trained in how to respond to folks who are experiencing traumatic incidents and to help guide them towards other resources. So even on the cases where we think we are not the appropriate authority to be responding, we try to make sure to direct people to the right place.
Can you put a face on this? Obviously, you can't give us names or anything, but give us an example of a complaint that might come in that your office would act on.
Well, we receive many complaints related to the Department of Corrections. We receive those complaints from corrections officers and staff and from families of incarcerated people. And in all of those cases, we assess whether they fall under our purview. And in particular, when we identify a kind of system-wide problem, that's when we start to delve in. And so you may recall that we issued a report last year about faulty drug testing that was brought to our attention both by corrections officers and
Yeah, and it's called staff. Microgenics.
And that was the name of the vendor. who was supplying the testing strips that were indicating the presence of narcotics in the urinalyses of incarcerated folks when they had not ingested any illegal drugs. And DOCS was, in response to that test, administering discipline. So that's an area where when you see a number of complaints come in, that we start to say there's clearly something going on here that requires a response.
Yeah, but beyond that, you are looking at more than just DOCS, right? I mean, you're not just looking at the Department of Corrections. I even printed from your website here, under New York State Executive Law, Article 4A, the Inspector General has jurisdiction over all executive branch agencies, departments, divisions, officers, boards, and commissions, and over most public authorities and public benefit corporations. The functions and responsibilities include receiving and investigating complaints, as we talked about, concerning allegations of corruption, fraud, criminal activity, conflicts of interest, or abuse in any entity under the Inspector General's jurisdiction, which of course includes the executive, the governor's office, and you have to watch that office. And there's always questions. There were questions about the last inspector general, maybe too cozy with the governor, let's say, or not tough enough. But beyond that example, how do you look at your role here? Do you have the spine, if you need to investigate the governor if it comes to that?
Absolutely. And I was very clear when I was approached that I would only serve as inspector general if I was given the full ability to do it independently. And I'm very fortunate that I have not experienced any meddling from the executive chamber, that my staff is able to pursue all of our investigations to their full conclusion. And one major distinction between me and prior inspectors general is that I don't sit as a member of the governor's cabinet. From the very beginning, we agreed that that was not only important for there to be an actual firewall between us, but also for people to have confidence that there was a firewall between us. So not being a member of the cabinet is a very important feature of this administration. And I think that there is almost no point in having a watchdog who is in any way beholden to their appointing authority. And for what it's worth, you know, I serve for the duration of the term of the appointing governor, which does mean that I'm not subject to the political whims of that governor because I'm here as long as the governor is.
That's New York State Inspector General Lucy Lang. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Giustina. In addition to battlefield tactics and military history, the Army's future leaders at West Point are learning about climate change. Under an initiative the Army started last year, cadets at the Military Academy are trying to help the Defense Department solve climate challenges that could affect national security. Reporting for the Legislative Gazette, WSHU's Desiree DiOrio has more.
The next presentation here is going to be energy resilience of Army infrastructure. Take it away.
In an auditorium adorned with West Point's motto, Duty, Honor, Country, seniors presented their capstone projects as they geared up for graduation. One group's presentation focused on the possibility of transitioning the Army's tactical vehicles to a fully electric fleet and modeling what the charging infrastructure would look like on the bases.
In conclusion, we can see that we have the data necessary to analyze the current Army's non-tactical vehicle fleet, and we have the knowledge of the EV replacements to conduct a lifecycle analysis.
Gregory Langoni, an engineering major, is one of the cadets who worked on the project. After his presentation, he said the work he's done as a student will have a direct impact on the work he'll do when he becomes an officer.
We're going to be seeing this technology roll out, and we're going to be some of the first people to actually see it in action and use it.
Professors and fellow cadets weren't the only audience members. So was Paul Farnan from the Army Office of Installations, Energy, and Environment. That office oversees energy use on Army installations. Farnan says the cadets' work on charging infrastructure directly affects him as he works to get bases ready for more electric vehicles.
What they're developing here, I want to turn around tomorrow and actually get it onto the installations.
Farnan's office has teamed up with West Point to form the Sustainable Infrastructure Resilience and Climate Consortium. They're working to prepare the next generation of leaders for the climate change challenges they face now and into the future. Farnan says the focus is on solutions.
Let's take the real-world big Army problems that our soldiers are facing every day in their training on the battlefield, and let's use this academic institution to apply the theory behind it, and then as they figure it out in theory, let's take it and put it into the hands of soldiers, and let's test it out in the real world.
Farnan says those challenges include fuel efficiency and how to store backup power.
We've been working with these students throughout the course of the academic year. The ingenuity, the knowledge, the different perspective that they bring is incredible.
Professors at West Point say the consortium's work transcends political debates over climate change and over what the military's priorities should be. Colonel Corey James runs the Department of Chemistry and Life Science.
Sometimes these topics get watered down with politics, and that's unfortunate. And some would say, well, you're trying to do things that would take away the Army and the military's ability to fight in one of the nation's wars.
James says the opposite is true. Preparing for climate change is in line with the Academy's mission to educate and train cadets on how to win wars.
Being more efficient will obviously help us with carbon emissions and those sorts of things, but it will likely make us more survivable and resilient on the battlefield.
Cadets are not only studying how to electrify and charge military vehicles. They're also researching how water, either too much or too little, will affect geopolitics, how extreme weather is impacting bases, how artificial intelligence can play a role in energy efficiency. Langoni, the West Point senior, says he's proud to know his project on electric vehicles could have a real-world use for the Army.
There is a group of five, like seniors in college, but we're working for the Office of the Assistant Secretary of the Army, and the findings that we come up through this project can drastically affect how the Army is acquiring electric vehicles, both domestically in the United States and in our installations.
Langoni says when he becomes an officer, he plans to continue studying the feasibility of the charging infrastructure models he developed as a student. And he says if the technology can work on Army bases, civilians could benefit in cities as well. I'm Desiree DiOrio on Long Island.
That about does it for this week's show. The Legislative Gazette is a production of WIMC Northeast Public Radio. We had help from the New York State Public Radio Network. You can listen to the Legislative Gazette anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. Look for program number 2323. And join us again next week at the same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina.